I just wanted to start by acknowledging the territories that we're all on and honor the struggles of all the Indigenous peoples of this land that have come here before us. In terms of talking about migration, obviously the forces of migration are completely linked to capitalist forces, and when we talk about having an anti-capitalist analysis and an anti-war analysis, that incorporates analysis around why people migrate. And when we think about war, globalization, occupation, essentially the purpose of all of those processes is linked to the forces of capitalism, which is the expropriation of resources and the ability to control Indigenous people's lands and territories and control the resources and be able to commodify those resources. And it's sort of, you know, a common theme that often comes up is that, well, globalization is merely the new name for colonialism that Indigenous peoples have been experiencing for 500 years, and it's a form of colonialism that people around the third world have been experiencing for centuries. It's just another name that we've given it. Two examples I want to share in particular, because they're sort of campaign specific, that a group that I work with in Vancouver called the South Asian Network for Secularism and Democracy is working on, there are two campaigns based in India or in solidarity with people in India, and there are two of them that sort of are linked to the anti-globalization movement. One is against De Beers, which, as people know, is a major diamond corporation for diamond mining and diamond production. And what De Beers has recently done in the past decade in India, in addition to obviously all the mining and expropriation that's gone on, in particular what we're targeting is that recently in India there's been an increasing push to have labor standards acts in India to protect against the increasing rise of child labor in India. And what De Beers has done is that the Factory Act in lots of parts of India stipulates that a factory constitutes of a working environment of more than 10 people, of up to 10 people. That's sort of the general Factory Act in India. And what De Beers has done, and others have followed suit, is that they have gone ahead and registered each diamond cutting table, which will have anywhere from 3 to 6 people, as a separate factory. That way they're able to obviously get around the Factory Standards Act and any child labor standards. And it really highlights sort of the amount of racism that goes into this, because a lot of times when people talk about child labor in the third world, people think of it as somehow intrinsic to the culture, that, you know, people in India just happen to employ their children in these industries. But when you actually look at the way that this is going about, it's that a corporation is implementing certain policies so that people are forced into accepting these working standards, right? So it really goes to the root of what people think is the cause of child labor, and it's not intrinsic to anything in the third world that we're somehow able to give out our children to do work. So that's one that we're working on. And another one is, and people might be familiar with this, is a growing campaign against Coca-Cola, not only in India, but also in Colombia, for example, in Palestine, in Northern Africa, and a lot of campuses around Canada where Coke has exclusive contracts on campuses. Coca-Cola in India currently, there's three and a half to four campaigns around India, in different regions of India, against Coca-Cola. One of the more recent ones is that Coca-Cola, in the last year and a half, has opened up a factory in Rajasthan, which is northwestern India. It's essentially the desert area of India, very close to going towards the Middle East. And they've opened up a factory up in Rajasthan because there was a lot of court cases going on in two other regions of India where Coca-Cola was being taken to court in Varanasi, for example, and one of the Coca-Cola factories theirs was shut down, so they decided to move up to Rajasthan. And Rajasthan is a desert, and what Coca-Cola has done is they've been able to claim the aquifers, which is sort of the under-the-ground water, tables of water in Rajasthan, and have established control and jurisdiction over it. And it's estimated by them being able to take control of all of this water, over 3,000 families in the area no longer have access to basic water, which is what they depend on because it's a drought-ridden region, for basic needs, cooking, bathing, any basic water supply that they need has been reduced. So 3,000 families now have no access to water because it's been completely corporatized by Coke. And certainly there's many, many other examples of what's going on in terms of corporate globalization around the world. Those are just two specifics. India recently amended its Patent Law Act in the last month so that corporations attempting, and this is going on all around indigenous territories here in Canada, where there's patenting of medicines and traditional knowledges, and India recently amended a Patent Law Act in order for multinationals to have access to traditional knowledges around India. So those are some of the examples and some of that history that we share in terms of the resources that are being expropriated and exploited and around the third world as well as around indigenous territories here. And in terms of obviously war and militarization, one example that I wanted to share with people is that when the elections in Iraq were going on in the last month, there was elections that were going on up in Shukwamuk territories, which is a nation up in BC, northern BC, and people might be familiar with the Shukwamuk Nation because they have the struggle against Sun Peaks Resort. That's sort of how people know about it. But they also had elections going on up there. And Janice Billy, who's the spokesperson for the Shukwamuk Protection Center, was saying that when she was listening on the news about the elections going on in Iraq, a few days before that there was elections going on for the Shukwamuk, the band council at Nisqually territories, and she was saying it was frighteningly similar because all of the political activists who were active against Sun Peaks Resort were forced at gunpoint to leave the election line up in Shukwamuk territories. And she was saying how when she was hearing in the news about how a lot of Iraqis were not, you know, obviously with the media spin on it, were not voting because they're afraid. They were either afraid of, quote unquote, the guerrillas, the Iraqi guerrillas, or of course they chose not to vote because there was no democratic elections in Iraq. She's saying she was reminded of the elections that were going on in Shukwamuk territories where people who were the defenders of the Shukwamuk Protection Center either decided not to vote because it was a rigged election, and the person that they'd wanted to stand in the elections, who was a defender also of Shukwamuk Protection Center, was basically thrown out of the election on some technicality. And others who were forced literally at gunpoint to leave the election line. So those are, you know, some histories that people have been sharing in terms of war and militarization and occupation around the third world and fourth world. One more anecdote was, people might be familiar with Whistler. Whistler's one of the largest ski resorts in Canada. It's sort of known all around North America. It's on Musqueam and Squamish territories in BC, and one of the guys, Don Bain, who works at the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, was telling us that, you know, now he's just talking about how obviously now people are fighting against Sun Peaks Resort, and 10 years ago, 15 years ago, he was wishing that the same fight had been waged against Whistler Resorts when Whistler basically became this municipalized territory and the Squamish and Musqueam people were displaced off their land. He was telling us that, you know, when people talk about globalization and economic development and trying to get indigenous peoples, and this obviously translates to third world peoples, when they're told, oh, you know, you should really embrace modernity, embrace economic development, it's for your own good. He was saying that. And Whistler, they implemented new electric lines and hydroelectric lines for this now, Whistler's basically a municipality. And the Musqueam and Squamish Nation that are located 2 minutes away and who were displaced off Whistler and are now just on, you know, these tiny reserves, they have been denied access to those same electric lines. And they have, and one of the reserves still has no electricity. And it is 2 minutes away from Whistler, which is this fucking Disneyland playground. And, you know, these chalets, and people have no access to electricity on this reserve. So that's one of the examples of, well, who's economic development for, obviously. And, you know, just through these examples of globalization and migration and displacement, it becomes apparent that the global sort of forces of apartheid are that when we talk about development, when we talk about colonialism, it's only for some people, and that apartheid system basically relegates a majority of the world's people to live without life, live without dignity, to live out without access to basic resources. And the greatest form of global apartheid is obviously, in this context, the denial of people citizenship rights or status rights, and citizenship sort of in the broad term, where people who are forced to migrate from... Can't slow down. It's an impossibility. people who are forced to migrate from their traditional territories and are attempting to make a life for themselves, whether they're internally displaced in Canada or being forced off reserves or even internally displaced into slum regions around the third world, or who are able even to migrate to territories in the first world. Even here, they're completely denied any entitlements and any rights. We work with a group of Latino refugees in the downtown east side in Vancouver, and they always say, well, you know, we are here because you are there, as in you being obviously the colonial forces are there in the third world. That's why we are here. We're not here for adventure. We're not here for any other reason. We have no desire to leave our homes, leave our families, and live here in utter desperation. We are here because you are there, and you are culpable for the reasons that we are being forced to migrate. You are culpable for that. And for settler states and colonial states to have the audacity to treat status and citizenship like it's some compassionate thing that's being granted is massively offensive to us, right? Because this is why we're migrating. We're not here at anyone's behest or anyone's sort of compassion for us, because we don't believe that. So, and that sort of ties into when we talk about the global apartheid system, that very nicely sort of links into, well, then whoever has entitlement, and that's only in Canada, it's essentially the white Canadians in this country who have any entitlement to status and citizenship and who have that entitlement. And one of the myths that's commonly used against migrants is to delegitimize the struggles of refugees, is, and especially, for example, for the Latinos, they're said, well, you're all just economic migrants. You're not real migrants, right? You're not really refugees. And it's like, well, all refugees are economic migrants, and all migrants are essentially economic migrants. You can't separate people who are, quote-unquote, fleeing, you know, legitimate political violence from people who are from the capitalist forces that cause economic migration, right? So there's no distinction that can be made, and the refugee system in Canada really tries to divide people. You know, the convention refugee definition is that if you're an economic migrant, well, then you're not a refugee, and it's, well, they're not separable, because all of those forces of migration are essentially linked to capitalist systems. And within Canada, obviously, people are probably familiar that the reserve system in Canada that was established by the settler states around Canada and in the U.S. was later expropriated by South Africa, right? And so the ability to segregate and have this idea, well, we're separate, we're equal, but we're separate, and that the whole idea of apartheid in the local context of the reserve system and South African apartheid is well known to people. One example I remember from a few years ago from that to the Filipino community organized around and Pinay organized around was where I think it was Diva Agency, yes. Is that right?
Yeah.
Diva Agency, it's this auction agency, and they were auctioning out Filipino women as domestic workers. On their website they had, you can auction on a Filipino woman, you know, just like, you know, chattel, and remember that. And one program in Canada similar to what Tess was talking about is a migrant labor program, that's the Seasonal Agriculture Workers Program. That's in Ontario and also in BC, and in that you have agricultural workers coming mostly from Guatemala, Jamaica, and Honduras, who come as agricultural workers who work here sort of on a rotational basis for up to 25 to 30 years. They just keep coming back every 6 months, and are, you know, when the season's over, they're deported back or asked to repatriated, and they come back and forth for 30 years, are not able to bring their families here, are paid on average in BC. The average that people are getting paid doing berry picking and agricultural labor is $3 an hour. And, you know, no rights to status and no way to fight that. That underlying racism around who's entitled to status and who's not becomes very clear. And obviously the Indian Act imposes a completely discriminatory form of status that Indigenous people have to register under this colonial system to even be called, you know, Indians, to have status cards. And there's an increasing push for people to not register under the Indian Act, but then you're denied all of the rights, or technically access to anything. Some other stuff I want to touch on, but I don't have time, in terms of talking about sovereignty and sharing some of those histories between immigrant struggles and Indigenous sovereignty. But I guess I'll just end with, on the one hand, we talk about migration as being forced, you know, in terms of capitalist forces being able to essentially forcing people off their lands and territories, yet at the same time we have to recognize, and this is what Smile was talking about as well, that it's fundamentally a core aspect of self-determination for people to be able to determine where they want to live, how they want to live, and under what conditions they want to live. And although people are fleeing forced migration, it's on the flip side of it, one of the most profound acts of self-determination is to be able to determine how to move. And in that way, fighting for the regularization of status for migrants becomes incredibly important for all peoples to be able to stand up for, whether they're in the anti-war movement or anti-globalization movement, and start in fighting for the rights of indigenous sovereignties to determine how they want to be able to control the land and live on the land becomes a crucial part of being able to build a decolonization movement here in on Turtle Island and in North America.